Powell, reel number 8. Could you tell me, in general terms, what a squadron commander's duties were?
Well, the most important duty was to keep up the morale of the squadron, all the pilots. That meant that one had to keep them occupied during the non-flying periods. And also, of course, he received his orders from the wing headquarters, which would be to send so many patrols or escorts for a bomb raid, any particular bomb raid. And that he simply translated those orders from the wing into his own flights, and he'd detail his flights to go on these patrols or on the escort duty. And apart from that, it was always the same. All the fighter squadrons, of course, were engaged on offensive patrols or escorts to bomb raids as and when they occurred. There was little that one can say about that, except let me come on to the morale side of it. I was fortunate enough to have a spare hangar on that aerodrome at Deal Villas, and I thought what a marvellous thing I could do if I got a lot of cement, which was then very hard to come by, and made myself a rink where the officers could roller skate. And in order to get our roller skates, it was definitely an order that anybody who went on leave had to come back with two pairs of roller skates. And it seemed in no time at all we had quite a nice rink. But then, unfortunately, the supply of cement ran out. The way I got it was really through my own sergeant major, who knew the sergeant major of up in the lines, and with a bottle of whiskey changed here and there, I got so many bags of cement. Unfortunately, there was one corner of my rink which I couldn't get cement for. And just at that time, it was visited by the general, who was General Higgins. And he visited me, and the officers were in this hangar making a dickens of a noise as he was walking past. I tried to steer him away from it, but to my horror, he walked straight to the hangar, looked through, and then he said, "That's a very excellent idea." And snapping that remark up quickly, I said, "Well, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't finish the thing. I'm short of 2 bags of cement to finish that corner of the rink." And he said, "Well, if you put in requisition in a way which I can supply it," I said, "then I'll see that you get 2 bags." So I said, "Thank you very much," and I wrote in and asked if I could have 2 bags of cement for the floor of my erecting shop. Now, no one knew what an erecting shop was, neither did I, but sure enough, I got my 2 bags of cement and finished the rink. We used to play badminton on roller skates. We even played rugger on roller skates. And as it was a cement floor, a rink, I used to flood it with about 1/2 inch of water so that when you did fall, you at least had a chance of sliding rather than grazing yourself. But that was quite a popular entertainment. I think we must have been the only unit in France with its own roller skating rink. General Higgins was a gunner. And in the early days, when I met him at Netherhaven, he used to come into mess before we, of course, had any mess kit. But he wore his gunner's mess kit with his broad red stripe and his scarlet little bum freezer. And he wore an eyeglass, and he had a most enormous bottom. And he was known throughout the service, and I think will live merely with the name of Bum and Eyeglass. And he was quite a popular man, a very nice fellow, and I think everybody liked him immensely, apart from that name which he must have known he was called through as the years went by, that everybody referred to him as Bum and Eyeglass. The most difficult duty of a squadron commander, I found, was on the many occasions one had to write to the next of kin to advise them of the death or capture of their sons. That was a horrifying thing for a boy of 21 to have to do it. But it wasn't too bad. I remember one dear boy who I wrote about, and I was asked afterwards by an officer who came and had a meal with us in the mess. He said, "Tell me, Major, do you have to write these letters to the parents?" I said, "Yes, unfortunately, I do." And he said, "Well, I've got a copy of the Times, and one of your letters, the parent, the father, has said in the notice that his commanding officer writes, 'Knowing your boy as I did, I can only say that I'm sure he died happily in that he laid down his life for his king, country, and for you.'" Of course, in the question of casualties, I can't give the actual figures, but most squadrons, I think, had approximately the same number of casualties. My own didn't seem excessive, but it did mean that as soon as one had a casualty, it meant a new officer was sent out, and they were most inexperienced. And the difficulty was to get them to see hostile aircraft. When they'd come back from an offensive patrol, one after the other, I would ask, and they reported, "No hostile aircraft, no hostile aircraft." But by that time, my own experience was that if you put your nose over the line, you'd certainly, within a few minutes, be surrounded by the Albatross D-5. Mr. Richtover's circus was busy on the other side of the lines, and I couldn't understand it. I only imagined that they weren't going over the lines. They were keeping this side too far. So I arranged for an offensive patrol. And I said that I was going to take these officers out. That's while I was briefing them. And I said, "I want all of you to remember that on this day," I said, "we'll go up and do an offensive patrol. And you can be assured that you will have had a fight in the air before you come back." I was confident of that, and I arranged for a patrol, and I said that I would lead the patrol at 14,000 feet when I would cross the lines. The other flight of four machines, led by a flight commander, would fly at 17,000 feet, 3,000 feet above me, the object being that when I was attacked by the Albatross, then the top flight would be able to dive down on the German. So, in effect, I was the bait. For that particular flight, I put a 6-foot yellow streamer on my rudder and two red, yellow, and blue streamers on the wings. And my flight commander just had a streamer on his rudder. He was supposed to fly above, the 3,000 feet above me, and follow me where I went. I crossed over the lines at Amiens, and I turned left when I got over the lines and flew up to Douai. And when I turned about, I turned a right turn about, going further over the lines, following the plan that I had told the officers. I said that we will go on, and if we don't get any Germans at all, we'll gradually lose height. And if they don't come up, we will go down to the German aerodromes and shoot the blinking things on the ground. That, of course, was just sheer bravado, but I was so certain that as soon as we crossed, we'd soon be into a mess of it. I got up to Douai, and to my horror, we hadn't been attacked. And I thought, oh, damn, then I'll have to lose height and gradually carry out this hazardous trip to shoot the people in the aerodromes behind the lines. But I had only just turned about, and then the sky seemed filled with black crosses. There were Germans everywhere. And my flight commander came from the top flight. He fired a red light, which was the signal for hostile aircraft. Well, I'd seen them. They were there. And I got down onto the tail of a German, and I got him in my sight, which was an Aldus telescopic sight, But I thought, now, I'm not going to pull the trigger and blast off a lot of ammunition. I'll get this fellow so easily through the back of the head with the first three rounds. But I first had to get him right in the centre of the oldest sight. Well, as one, the gun was fixed, you see, you had to steer the aircraft rather than the gun. And this fellow, he just slipped out of this oldest sight to one side. I counter-ruddered and brought him back. I was just about to fire when another German who was on my tail, he fired, and he hit the instrument board. He hit me through the leg and through the arm. At the time, I didn't notice this except that I felt a bang. And that was my first experience of getting a bullet through me. I'd often visualize what the heck is it going to feel like, but of course one doesn't feel it. It's just a blow. And he was using armor-piercing bullets, which one went right through the V of the engine. It cut out one entire block of cylinders. There was a cloud of steam and water that went up. It had gone through the radiator. And I thought, my first reaction was, my God, fire. I knew I was at 14,000 feet, and I had to get down to the ground before the thing had disintegrated entirely in flames. Again, remembering we'd no parachutes. I dived down as hard as I could go and looked back, and I saw that I'd got three German albatross on my tail. Well, they were heavy machines, the albatross, the big engine, and it took much more. They weren't so manoeuvrable as the SE-5A. I was able to turn quickly in what we called an Immelmann turn, quickly and go underneath them on my way down with no engine. They took a long time to get round before their guns came onto me when I whipped round quickly the other way and went down. After I'd seen to be going down for about 4 weeks, I had to drag my eyes away from these Boches and look where I was. I was about 400 feet up in the air only, and I was passing over a marvellous field, which turned out eventually to be a German aerodrome, where I landed. And I got out. The German who shot me down, he came in and landed on the aerodrome as well. And the other two went round and round in circles, leaving a gun on my machine all the time. Rather well done. I got out of the machine, went to the little locker at the back, pulled off my flying helmet and put my cap on. Then I walked across to the German who was sitting there in his machine with the engine ticking over, and I'd forgotten, the excitement was so intense, I'd forgotten that I'd been hit. I went up to him and I put my hand out, because there was that sort of friendship, and he leant out to shake my hand. And as he did so, the first German word, I knew no German, but it's so much like English, he suddenly said, "Verwundet?" And that sounded like wounded, and I looked down and I saw blood running out of my sleeve. Then, of course, I felt it. I was then taken by two German soldiers wearing pickelhaubes, spiked helmets, and they bandage-chaired me and carried me across the road and into what would be a casualty clearing station, where I was put in a room, and there I waited until, some 2 hours afterwards, an officer arrived, a staff officer, and interviewed me. And as I was going into the casualty clearing station, there was a Feldwebel there with a book, and he said, "Your name?" I said, "Poel." He said, "Povel." And I said, he said, "Your regiment?" I said, "Royal Flying Corps." And he said, "Your rank?" And I said, "Major." And he looked at me and said, "99, Sergeant Major, Feldwebel." Because at that time a German major was an elderly man with a white moustache, and he couldn't understand how a boy could call himself a major. They didn't believe it. But when this staff officer came down, as I say, after about 2 hours, he came in, and there were a lot of Germans outside the door. He looked at me and he turned round and said, "Ja, ja, Major." And he then took me by road in a car, a staff car, and I was driven straight up to Douai. And on the way, I was amazed at the discipline of the Germans behind the lines. We, of course, being a sort of civilian army by that time, were very lax in discipline. A man would walk past an officer and just say, "Oh, blast another damn staff car." That afternoon, when I was driving in a German staff car, I noticed that all the troops, as they passed, they clicked round their heads with a most marvellous salute. It impressed even the captain I was with, the German captain. And after one particularly fine example of a party of body of troops, he turned round and said, "What do you think of that?" And I said, "It's excellent, excellent." But then we've always appreciated the fact that the Germans are good at discipline. And I was then taken up to Douai, where I was handed over to another German officer who interrogated me and asked me the usual things, my name, regiment, rank, which I gave him. And he said, "Your squadron." And I said, "Now, excuse me, Herr Hauptmann, but you know very well at this stage of the war that we are not allowed to give the number of the squadron." And he said, "Oh, that's quite all right." He said, "It just saves a little time. But," he said, "tell me, how is Major Tilney?" Now, Major Tilney had been in the Duke of Lancaster's yeomanry with me, and he eventually commanded number 40 squadron in the RFC. He was still commanding number 40 squadron when I was taken prisoner, but it was a great shock to find that right from my pre-war days,